I did have the good fortune to serve on the Nimitz before I ended my military career, and that was a nuclear class carrier, and that was spick and span. I mean, everything was shiny and new, and it was a beautiful, beautiful ship. But anyway, that's the way I picture it, with somebody coming in. And then they come in and they say, oh, and everywhere in the palace you see bulls. He's the symbol of strength. Now, King Minos, his symbol is a bull, and there's bull. And then all of a sudden people start talking, oh, did you hear her? There's a bull. There's a man over there with these bulls all over him. Next thing you know, the bull is a man, and he's a half man, half bull. And the whole myth grows up around it, and the labyrinth, and Athens is subject to Minos, and we've got to give these men and women every ninth year. And what are they doing with the woman? What are they doing with the men? Well, obviously, they're feeding them to the Minosaur. You know what I mean? They're feeding them to the bull that lives in the labyrinth, and the whole thing comes up. But see, the thing is, behind the myth is a measure of truth. I really believe that, okay? So, that's all we're going to say about that. Any questions? Comments? Concerns? Bible questions? Counseling needs? Prayer requests? Nothing. Okay. Let's continue then. Now we're going to talk a little bit about... Paul's going to run and get my notes for me off the counter of the office, and we're going to talk about literature. And while he does, I'm going to show you these books. These are some of my older books. A lot of times, these old books that I have a newer version of this, but I brought this one in because it's by W.H.D. Roos. And it's the finest translation I've ever read of the Iliad. It's not done in poetry. It's done in prose. It's done in just like reading a story. Very unique to find the Iliad done like that. It's usually done in epic poetry. And this is very good, very readable. I like it a lot. Also, this is a really good translation of the Odyssey. Thanks a lot, Paul. Appreciate it. This is a very good translation of the Odyssey by Fitzgerald. You can read this. Translations really differ. Some guys just are not as good as others. They may be very good scholars and all that, but they're just not very readable. You know, they translate them so literally that they lose something. It's not good to read. We had to read both of these, unfortunately. These deal with the Trojan Wars. One is, Achilles and the Trojan War and Agamemnon and all that. They go and fight the Trojan War. It takes 10 years to finally take the city of Troy. And we're not going to study it in detail in this class, and I'm going to tell you why, because... whether or not it really happened the way these guys say, we don't really know. The most important thing about Homer is he's a very good writer, and he didn't write anything. It was all oral tradition, but he's an excellent epic poet. And number two, the things that he says become law to the Greeks. They really believe this guy. The Odyssey is what is his name now? Odysseus. Odysseus' travels back from the Trojan War. He's coming back home. And you should see the trip this guy's got back home, boy. The Cyclops and the whole deal. This is the book that you're reading now, the old one. This is Oedipus the King by Sophocles. This is what I'm going to talk about a little bit now. And this is just a play, but it's pretty incredible. Pretty incredible play. Plays were written back then, not single. Tragedies were not written singular. They were written in trilogies, okay, in sets of three. What they would do is they would come up with a cycle, and every year they would have this massive contest to see who would be the greatest poet. Now, I'm going to tell you why that's important. It's important because of a thing called catharsis. And we'll talk about that in a minute. But they would write a series, three plays, three tragedies. And the Oedipus cycle, the Oedipus Rex cycle is Oedipus Rex, Oedipus et colon, and Antigone. Those three plays make one cycle for Sophocles. Okay, the person that wrote the best play during this festival won what was known as the laurel wreath. It was a crown. Now the crowns, I may spend some time on that in a couple of weeks explaining some of the crowns, because they're the same crowns. The Roman crowns and the Greek crowns are the same crowns that Paul uses to describe rewards that we receive at the Bema Seat Judgment. Yes?
They still give out the laureate awards for
paying them out. Right. Well, that's for the laureate is for mostly poetry, right? Uh-huh. Am I wrong? I think it's mostly just poet laureate. But the laurel wreath was a wreath that would be put upon your head, and you would be the greatest playwright of that day, and you would get all kinds of rewards as well. As you'll see, when you'll understand that better when we talk about Socrates and how he dies and stuff, and his trial before the jury, and how he says what he thinks he should get for a punishment. And lastly, I showed you Aristotle's Poetics is going to go into a lot of the things I'm going to talk about tonight. Okay, now when we talk about drama, we have to understand that it's basically going to begin with it's basically going to begin with the Greeks, and that's why we're going to study it here. This kind of phenomena of somebody putting on a play isn't really going to be known in the ancient world until we get to the Greeks. The word drama comes from the Greek word dran, D-R-A-N, which means to act, to act out, to do. Basically, the person wants to mimic the writings of the playwright. He wants to act out the story of the playwright. The Greek dramas were broken up into basically two different categories, the tragedies and the comedies. Now, the comedy, here's the main difference between them, okay? There are some brilliant comedies in the Greek language. Euripides wrote comedy. Aristophanes was probably the most famous comic playwright. But comedy to the Greek was nothing to be admired, someone that could really write comedy, because comedy was not ennobling. That's an important word when we talk about Greek drama. Let me erase this here. It was not ennobling. Ennobling. What is ennobling? Ennobling means it makes you a better person. The Greeks believed that drama had two categories. One is comedy. Comedy did not make you a better person. It entertained you. But tragedy made you a better person. It was ennobling. Okay? Now, all drama begins in religious ritual. All of it does. Basically, Greek drama begins with the worship of a god by the name of Dionysius. And Dionysus is the god of wine, basically. Now, you ready for this? Dionysus was supposedly a god, one of the sons of Zeus, one of the children of Zeus, who had taken on human form. This god had taken upon himself human form. The god Dionysius comes to earth for a short period of time, and he teaches his disciples. And as he teaches it, you seeing any parallels to this? Okay. As he's teaching his disciples, after his instruction is completed, he dies sacrificially on behalf of his people. Now, don't confuse, though, the cross with this, because it's completely different. He doesn't die vicariously for the sins of his people. It's not that kind of thing. But he dies for his people, okay, to show that his love for his people. After this, his disciples are expected to go out and win converts to Dionysus, and also to do certain rituals to remember him and to worship him by, to keep him happy, okay, and like in remembrance of him. Now, there are lots of parallels. You can see the way Christianity is being perverted here in a big way. And the devil is certainly understanding that the coming of the Lord... Remember, the devil knows that Jesus Christ is coming all the way back in Genesis 3:15, when the proto-evangelium is given, and you know that whole prophecy about from the seed of the woman, he shall bruise your side, he shall bruise your heel, but he shall crush his head. You know, and that's dealing with Satan, his head being crushed by Jesus at the second coming, but Jesus' heel being bruised by Satan at the cross. You get the idea? A temporary bruising, you know, but then finally there's total and utter defeat. Now, Satan understands this right from Genesis chapter 3. Did you have a question, no. Tony? Oh, okay. So you can see the parallels here, okay? It's absolutely astounding. Now, One of the big things, folks, is that this is all wrapped up in ancient fertility rites. This is a book, by the way, Sir George Frazer wrote a book by the name of, what is the name? The Golden Bough. Anybody ever hear of it? The Golden Bough is the most famous book that you can get on, you know, ancient cultic kind of practices and stuff. You go to your library, there'll be 4 or 5 copies of it, The Golden Bough. He's kind of ecliptic and difficult to read, and he's not indexed very well, but he's fun. He's a lot better than reading Joseph Campbell. See, this is the kind of thing we were talking about. Joseph Campbell last time, the man with... How many know who Joseph Campbell is? Okay, this guy spent his life studying myths. Bill Moyer from PBS did this whole thing, you know, interviewing the guy before he died. And he spent his whole life on myths, but here is his whole idea. He's not a Christian. And his whole idea, the whole key behind this guy, Joseph Campbell, is that, well, look at Dionysius. How can you believe in Jesus when Dionysius predates him by, you know, 500 years, and it's basically the same thing? It's a fertility ritual. That's all it is. Now, that's what Dionysius was. The problem is Jesus Christ was the Son of God. And the key is, all of this is perfectly proven. I mean, listen, if you have any doubt about your Christian faith, read Josh McDowell. He's very easy to read, and I'm going to tell you something. There is, by the time you get done reading him, you almost don't even need faith to believe in the Bible. It is so proven by history, by archaeology, by common sense. It's held up against, and I know you've done some of this, Derek, you hold it up to get against any other philosophical concept, and it's the only one you can live by. It's an amazing study, apologetics with the Bible. So the idea is this: you don't have a faith that is not reasonable and is not rational. Joseph Campbell mixes all this up together, and he says, see, Dionysus, all it is Jesus is just another Dionysus that comes later. And the Virgin Mary is just another Inanna. And then Inanna becomes, you know, all the way down. You know, remember all the names I gave you of Inanna? And then, well, the Virgin Mary is just the latest Inanna on the block. And that's what I really despise about Joseph Campbell. He's also got this saying that I absolutely can't stand called, follow your own bliss.
Is he still alive?
No, he died. He had this thing called follow your own bliss. In other words, his theory was that everybody needed their own myth. You can't live without your own myth. And hey, guess what? Our myth is Jesus. Good, good. You go on and your myth is Jesus. That's great. That'll give you something to live for. And you're going to die and, you know, who knows what's on the other side anyway. Well, guess what? He believes Jesus isn't a myth now, I guarantee you that much. Mm-hmm. He knows the truth now, unfortunately. Okay. It all begins in religious ritual and a communal thing, okay? This community gets together now, and they're worshiping Dionysus, and they're all getting drunker than skunks, and there's all kinds of sexuality involved in this because it's a fertility ritual. The idea is this. In these ancient fertility cults, folks, somebody has to... the king would reign for 1 year. Now, this isn't necessarily ancient Greece, but these are ancient fertility cults and basically how they come about, okay? I'm backtracking a little bit. In the ancient fertility cults, a king, a young, very, very young king, would come. The king wouldn't necessarily be the ruler. He would be, the warrior would be the ruler. But the king would be elected. They'd get the most handsomest, youngest, virgin man that they could find, and they would make him the king for 1 year. He would become the king in the spring. At the end of the spring, guess what would happen to him? He'd be sacrificed. And his death, going under, would what? Cause the spring to come. Because what would happen? A new king would come. The new king, his death, the blood of his death would bring the new king. It's fertility ritual. So they believed that this was a form of a fertility. Does everybody understand what I mean? In other words, they're understanding the cycle of everything dying in the winter and coming back to life in the spring. They're understanding that life and death thing, and they're mixing it together with human sexuality and all kinds of things like that. And they're coming up with these kinds of cults, okay, basically is what is happening. The regeneration, procreation, and the giving birth idea, all being wrapped up together as a cycle. And they're seeing that as just a cycle in nature. So all of these cults would take place. Now, what would happen is In Dionysus' case, it was a little bit different. They would get together and they would worship Dionysus. And by worshiping his death, they didn't necessarily have to kill somebody. By worshiping his death, they would, and acting out portions of his life. Did you hear that? Acting out portions of his life, they would ensure a good harvest for the next year, ensure that the spring would come, okay? The way they did this was this. They went into sacred groves. They're always in sacred groves, folks. The druids are in sacred groves. In fact, the word druid, druid comes from the word drew, which means oak, and they worshipped the oak tree. It's unbelievable. Can you imagine worshipping a tree? You think you have a god? You think that you have a religion without substance? Listen to their religion. I mean, we have a religion with that's based on the absolute final word of God. They're worshipping a tree. Oh, a leaf fell. A leaf fell. Oh, holy leaf. Holy. Oh, don't touch it. Don't touch it. Don't touch it. We'll turn into frogs. You know. So the idea is they're doing these kinds of cults, and by worshipping Dionysus, they get together in these sacred groves, and what they do is act out portions of the god's life on earth, while he was on earth. We're going to see it in Christianity later with the passion plays, and then later with the, there's the passion plays, then the pageants, then the morality plays, and then we get into secular plays about history, and then secular plays, period. There's a progression to drama. Later on, we're going to see that, we'll talk about it in a minute. Here's what happens. They're in the sacred groves, and according to their beliefs, Dionysus had two kinds of followers. Women, who were called nymphs, and men, who were half men, half goat. Okay? and they were called satyrs. I'll write that word down. S-A-Y-T-R-S. That's the word. Oop. They were called satyrs. The men were called satyrs. The women were called nymphs. Okay? Now, they would get into the woods. Here's what they would do. They'd get into these sacred groves, and the men would get down on all fours, and they would strap goat skins to their bodies, and they would run around singing chants, acting out parts of the life of Dionysius. Okay? And they would get all worked up in a fury, and they'd be dancing around. And the more they danced around, and the longer the night went, and it would go on and on and on, and the longer the night went, and the more worked up they would get all emotional, really, really emotional. And they'd really work it up, and they'd get it going. I mean, you've seen some of this in Christian churches even, or in the voodoo cults, the emotion thing, getting really, really worked up, and really worked up where you're not even thinking anymore. And what would happen is you become, as the more emotional you get, the more involved with the life of the god you are, you're getting all worked up and identifying with the life of Dionysius, with the suffering of Dionysius, with the teachings of Dionysius. You're becoming all involved in his life. And as you're doing this, you're becoming cleansed, or you're getting a catharsis. C-A-R-T-H-I-T-H-S-I-S. Very important word. Let me show you this. Catharsis looks like this. Catharsis. A catharsis means cleansing. And you would identify with the life of Dionysius and you would be cleansed. And you're running around the woods singing what?
Goat songs.
And you have goat skins on your back, and this is a tragedy. The tragedy is the god has died. Winter has come. The god has died. Pray to him. Pray to him that he will bring forth what? Spring. And of course, he's the god of wine, inebriation. And also the fruit of the vine is always linked up with prosperity. You know, the fruit of the vine, grapes. You know, remember the kings who were sitting there and, you know, these women are popping grapes and that kind of thing, you know. So the whole thing is a complete circle. Now, here's what happens. We begin with very small pockets of this kind of thing happening in the Greek mountainsides and all of this. All of a sudden, not all of a sudden, gradually, it becomes, I just say all of a sudden as something to say. Gradually, what happens is many more people become convinced that Dionysus is the god. He becomes the god of choice. And what happens is the polices are setting themselves up. I just had my blue pen. The polices are setting themselves up so that we have the Greek thing here like this. It's getting uglier every time, huh, folks? That's Greece, and we have all these polices, all these little city-states popping up everywhere, and they're everywhere. And in Athens, this thing really catches on. And the people get together and they say, hey, listen, we've got to build some kind of a place where we can have the life of Dionysius acted out so everybody can see it. And what do they build? The amphitheater. They build the amphitheater, which is basically an outdoor, you know what an amphitheater is, right? It's got a stage. But they build it into the side of cliffs, into the side of a mountain, so that when the person talks, 5,000 people back can hear them. It echoes. The sound carries. I mean, acoustically, it's absolutely magnificent. And what the Greek dramas are, folks, is they are not convenient little plays. They are religious experiences that every single... Listen, you have to... Hey, listen, you get a little letter in the mail that says you got to appear such and such a date for what? Jury duty. The same thing happened in Greece. You had to appear as part of the chorus. Now, let me show you how this worked. Here's the stage, folks, and here's the mountain. Picture this is the mountain. Here are all the seats. Go like this. Okay, now, this is terrible. I'm sorry. There's a stage, little stage here. You see how that is, kind of? Everybody kind of get the idea? This is the back of a mountain. These are the rows of seats. And all they are gigantic stone benches. Okay? Almost as comfortable as Schaefer Stadium. Anybody ever been to Schaefer Stadium, like December 24th, to see the Giants and the Patriots or something, and they have aluminum seats? And you're like, it's the middle of winter, you know, aluminum seats. You're not getting the picture. Aluminum, flesh, warm, yeah. So the idea is this, they're very perfect, though, acoustically. They're really, really nice. And over here on the stage is where the tragedy is acted out. The tragedy is not like we think of a play, Death of a Salesman, you know, where, Arthur Miller's Death. How many have seen Death of a Salesman? Absolutely, absolutely magnificent play. I mean, one of the, I just saw it recently. I had to study it in this literature class, and I just saw a recent adaptation of it by, when Dustin Hoffman was in it. Absolutely magnificent. It was done a few years ago. Absolutely magnificent. What's the guy's name again? What is it? No. I mean the name of the character, the father, the salesman. It's really funny. I have it at the tip of my tongue, but you know the whole thing about there's this whole thing with him and his sons, and he catches finds out that his father's committed adultery, and this whole crazy thing. I know I can't remember it either now. I have it in this book though. At the end of the play, he goes off into a car, and you hear like a car crash, you know, and they realize. Okay, now listen to this though. In this, it's not like that though. It's not conventional play like that. You know what? This is going to drive her absolutely bananas. So hold on for just a second. I know we got it in here. You know what? I bet I even have it in my notes. The guy's name. Yeah. Willie Loman. Well, and of course, all of that is symbolic. Loman, low man, always wanting to be the, you know, and the Cosma, the whole city is always wants the American dream and the white picket fence, and everything's symbolic. Okay, it's different in these days. There is a very definite way, a very definite convention, what we call in drama convention, a series of rules that we have to work by. And we don't have this kind of thing like we have today in drama. Anybody know who Samuel Beckett is? How many have heard of you've heard of Waiting for Godot? This guy wrote a... This is... Oh, no. This is the theater. He wrote... Samuel Beckett wrote in the Theater of the Absurd. Okay? And he wrote a play called Waiting for Godot. The play is about... Dave, have you ever heard of it? Oh, it's this thing like played to packed houses now. Only thing on the stage, I got to take a minute to tell you about this. Only thing on the stage, since we're talking about drama, only thing on the stage is a tree. And the tree is blooming, you know. And there's some guys over there, and they come on stage, and they're, You see him? No, I haven't seen him. It's supposed to be coming. He's never going to come. Where is he? I don't know. He should be coming any minute. The guy takes some three things out of his pocket, starts juggling a little bit. Puts them back in his pocket. It's absolutely absurd is right to watch. Now, you're watching this thing, and they go through the whole act. Now, this whole thing, you know, maybe goes a half an hour. Nothing, absolutely zero, nothing, nilch, not a nothing happens. Okay? They come back. The scenes have changed. Second act, there is a tree that's dying. And they're out there. I'll tell you what. I'd like to know when he's going to get here. he's not coming. He's not coming. And the whole act goes on, and nothing happens in the whole play. Now, this has been called a masterpiece, and it all depends what your frame of reference is. Does anybody have any idea what they're getting at?
The Return of Christ. Yeah, a D movie, right?
Waiting for Godot.
Oh, God.
They're waiting for God. And it's a comment on society where there are a series of people there, and at the beginning of their life, they're waiting. Oh, he's got to be coming. And the tree is blooming, and they're optimistic. And at the end of their life, the tree is dying, and they've lost faith. Where is he? Now, the play, Beckett goes a long way to say nothing. I mean, the play lasts a long time with people walking around the stage. And what is the idea? Absurdity. The absurdity of life, existentialism. This whole concept of we're living out the daily grind and getting nowhere. Getting absolutely nowhere. It's the myth of Sisyphus. Anybody know that myth of the guy that rolls the big thing up the top of the big rock, keeps rolling it up to the top of the top of the mountain, and then when he gets to the top of the mountain, what does it do? So what does he do? Starts rolling it back up again. And the futility of life, and this whole myth that life is futile. As a matter of fact, and this is such an important philosophical concept in the 20th century, that Albert Camus, who C-A-M-U-S, a famous philosopher, is going to spend a lot of his life writing books dealing with this question. If life is so absurd, and all we are here to do is to live and die, and he's an existentialist and he believes that, if all we're here to do is to live our lives and die, then why not commit suicide? And he writes a book called The Myth of Sisyphus, which is an absolutely brilliant intellectual argument why a person should not kill themselves without God. And you know what? Basically, without God, the Bible says you have no hope. You're without eternal life. You're without Christ. You're without hope. But he goes and he deals with this myth of Sisyphus, the life of Roy, and he comes up with some very good arguments why a person shouldn't kill themselves. He also wrote a very more popular book called The Stranger, or L'Étranger in the French. And L'Étranger is a book about a guy who kills some people, and just for the sake of doing it. No remorse, no nothing. And at the end of the book, no, he does it because he's an existentialist, and he just does whatever he feels like doing, and he doesn't care about any consequences. At the end of the book, and every book has a climax, folks, the climax of this book is he's sitting in a cell, and he's about to die. And he's like, there's one scene in the book where a girl walks up to him and says, she likes him a lot. And she says, I want to marry you. Will you marry me? And he says, okay. And she says, I really love you, you know. And he says, good. And she says, do you love me? And he says, that's a stupid question. It doesn't even matter. Existentialism, that's what it is. It doesn't matter. So at the end of his life, he's sitting there inside of a cell, and he's waiting to die, and he's waiting to go out there and be killed, and a priest comes in. And the climax of the book is the priest comes in, and he goes, listen, my son, you can repent. You can get yourself right with God. He says, look at the stones. Look at the stones in the wall. Look hard at the stones in the wall, and you'll see the face of our Christ. Look at the stones in the wall. Look at them. And he's telling the guy, and he goes, look. And the guy grabs him, and he says, look, what do you see? And the guy says, I see nothing. I see nothing at all. That's existentialism. Nothing. And that's why Ernest Hemingway, who was an existentialist, is going to find out in his life that he has cancer and he's going to put a shotgun in his mouth. Because they have no hope. You can't live by that kind of philosophy. That's the theater of the absurd. Let's go back to the theater of ancient Greece. Ancient Greece is different. We have people on the stage who are basically going to interact with a chorus, which are a group of men who are on, for lack of a better term, jury duty. It keeps changing. The chorus will go, the chorus is over here like this. And the chorus doesn't go, you know, hallelujah, hallelujah. Not that kind of chorus. He goes, Oedipus will come out and say, there is a plague in Athens. And the chorus will go, there is a plague in Thebes. And the chorus will, in unison, go, you must help us. You're the king. You must help us get rid of this plague. And then there will be some acting. And then the chorus will make a comment on what they see. That's how it is. It's very boring to watch if you have ever seen it. How many have ever seen it? All right. But let me show you what's happening here, because there is a deeper significance than the boring play itself. The idea is, in tragedy, and this is where Aristotle comes in, and he is so brilliant. He is so brilliant. He comes in and he says, the main idea behind a tragedy is that a tragic hero must have... Miller is so famous when he writes Death of a Salesman is because Death of a Salesman completely shatters this idea of the tragic hero. Shakespeare knew what a tragic hero was. Hamlet was a tragic hero. Now here are the three things, and write them down. The three things that a tragic hero must have in ancient Greek tragedy. Number one, he must be neither too good nor too bad. He must be neither too good nor too bad. Number two, he must be of noble birth. He must be of noble birth. And number three, and most important of all, he must have a tragic flaw. He must have a tragic flaw. Now, this is the idea behind this. Number one, he must neither be too good nor too bad. Let me explain to you what's happening. At one point in time, everybody in Athens is going to church. And where they're going to church, where are they going to church? They're going to the amphitheater. They're going to church at the amphitheater. And they're going to watch something that's going to be church to them. Now, there's a method to all this stuff. Why is this word on the board, ennobling? Because tragedy is ennobling. Why is it ennobling? Okay, here we have him. Paul Ferreira is a Greek. Lives in Athens. He's going to church. It's the day of the big festivals, okay? The Greek tragedies are going to be played on. Now, Paul's going to sit there, and he's going to watch this series of plays, okay? And he is a person who is watching very carefully. And this guy comes out by the name of Oedipus. Oedipus is the tragic hero, okay? Now, Paul is going to watch Oedipus, and he's going to look at him and he's going to notice a couple things. Number one, he's neither too good nor too bad. And the reason for that is simply this. Because if Paul was a bad guy, then Paul couldn't identify with him. In other words, when the bad guy gets his at the end, everybody's happy. Right? Nor could he be too good, because if he's too good, Paul would still not be able to identify him because he would be almost angelic or godlike. People aren't like that. You get the idea? So Paul wants to look at a guy, a tragic hero. The idea is that Paul's going to identify with, watch it now, Paul's going to identify with a tragic hero who's neither too good nor too bad. And when the tragic hero comes to a catastrophe because of his tragic flaw, Paul is going to say, oh my God, but for the grace of God go I. That could be me. I'm proud like that. Or pride is a big thing, hubris. This is one of the most common tragic flaws. It's called hubris. And it means an overbearing pride. A man who's basically good, but he's got an overbearing pride, and he's proud, and it causes his downfall. You get the idea? Now, you know what, Paul? You're watching this play, and you're watching this man who's neither too good nor too bad. Why do you think he has to be of noble birth? Well, not necessarily that, but he must be perceived, in order for the play to work, as having the means to overcome the problem. You get the idea? And a prince can always do that. A king can always do that. That's why Hamlet's a prince. Hamlet must be a prince if he's going to avenge King Hamlet. You know, when he's going to stand there, to be or not to be, whether 'tis nobler for the mind to suffer the slings and arrows of outrageous fortune, to shuck off this mortal coil, to sleep or perchance to dream, and by sleeping, and on it goes. Now, the idea is this. Hamlet has to be able to be perceived by the person watching it. Here's Hamlet. He knows that his father's been murdered. The ghost, King Hamlet, appears at the beginning of the play, and he knows that his father's been murdered, and he's got to be perceived by the people watching it as having the power to avenge his father's death. And only him being a prince allows him to do that. You understand? Gives him access into the palace. Now, Paul, you're sitting there not because you want to sit there and enjoy a nice play like Arthur Miller. You're sitting there because you want your soul cleansed. You want catharsis. You want a religious, emotional experience. And when you watch the tragic hero and you see him fall, get it? You're going to say, oh my goodness, that could be me. I've got to watch my pride. It's a sermon. That's all it is. It's a sermon. Now, the most famous folks, I'm not going to give you another break tonight because we've only got 25 minutes left and I want to finish this. So let's finish Oedipus, okay? Here's what happens. Here's what happens. How many need a break? Does anybody need a break? No. Okay. If you do, you could just go up and get a coffee and come back. That's fine. Oedipus is a baby. Okay. Let me tell you the story of Oedipus. He's a baby and he's got a father and a mother. Now, when Oedipus is born, it's a brilliant, fantastic plot. I mean, it really is. When Oedipus is born, folks. A seer comes to his father. His father's a king. His father is the king of Thebes. His father's the king of, I forget. His father's a king. What he does is he goes and a prophet comes to him and says, oh, your son will someday kill you. You shall someday fall by the hand of your own son. Well, back in those days, they believed these seers. So what happens is, here's the way the Greeks did it. And by the way, this is something that was done in the ancient world many times. They would expose their children to the weather so that the gods of the weather would kill them and not them. What they do is they say, we can't have the child in the house. I am not going to be killed by my own son. So they drill a hole through his ankles, folks. And they put a bar in between his ankles and they bolt them together so that he's immobile. Now, this is a baby, okay? And in fact, the word Oedipus means crippled or slow-footed or something like that. It's got that kind of word. Bless you. Now, Oedipus is given to, the baby is given to a soldier, and the soldier is commanded to take the baby up onto the mountain and leave it there and let the gods do what they will. So the parents have nothing to do with killing this child. It's the gods who are doing it. You get the idea? Because, you know, the gods would get back and retaliate on them. Okay. Well, the soldier is so kind-hearted and so broken by the fact this child has been abused in this way that he runs into a shepherd, and then he helps him up. No, I'm only kidding. A little bit of humor there. A little funny man stuff. I'm sorry. He runs into a... He runs into a shepherd, a poor shepherd, and the shepherd says, give the child to me. The king and the queen will never know, and I know a couple who will take him, who are looking for a baby who's ankles are poor. I know a couple who's looking for a baby whose ankles are bolted together. So... Oh, boy, you are out of your mind. We ought to tag team teach this next time. The idea is this, okay? So they know they know someone, okay? The person that he knows, ladies and gentlemen, are the king and queen of Corinth, okay? He happens to gain favor with the king and queen of Corinth, and he gives the child to them, and the child is obviously crippled. He walks like a person who's had their ankles killed. So the idea is this now. But they adopt the baby, and they love the baby, and the child grows up. When the child is a young man, he hears tell of this rumor that he would kill his... Now, he doesn't know he's adopted, okay? He does not know he's adopted. He hears tell of this rumor that he will kill his father, and he loves his father with all of his heart. So he leaves, you know, just like the dentist and Rudolph. Remember? Remember the dentist and Rudolph? I want to be a dentist. If you don't mind my nose. And they're leaving because they're misfits, you know. Well, he's like a misfit. He doesn't want to kill his, his father, so off he goes. While he's going, he comes to a crossroads. And at the crossroads, he meets an old man. And the old man says, "Move out of the way, young fella. I'm going through first." And Oedipus is stubborn. Ah, stubborn. Oh, what's that sound like?
Hubris.
Stubborn. Tragic flaw. Tragic flaw, right? Stubborn, tragic flaw. Okay. Stubborn. "No, I'm going through." Neither one of them will yield the way one to the other. They fight it out, and guess what? Not Sophocles. Oedipus kills the man and passes on through. He comes to a place, and boy, I can't remember the name of the kingdom, but he comes to a kingdom. And there is a woman there who's a woman, the queen, who's recently been widowed. The queen has recently been widowed. And he comes in and she begs him, "Oedipus, are you wise? For our entire city has been held bondage by the Sphinx for years. And the Sphinx is this crazy thing. It's lion and man and all this stuff. Okay? But this monster thing has held the city hostage with a riddle. And until somebody can crack the riddle, the city will be held hostage. And here's the riddle." How many know the story, first of all? You know the answer? All right, here's the question. The Sphinx. Here's the question that the Sphinx asks. He says, "What goes on four legs in the spring, two legs in the summer, and three legs in the winter, and is weakest when it stands on the least number of legs?" That's the question. Who knows what the answer is? Man. And as a child, on four arms and legs, in the spring, in the summer, on two legs, and the cane, right? In the winter. And he's strongest when he stands on the least number of legs, right? Now, so the Sphinx, and there's a magnificent poem. I promised to bring it in for you next time. I brought this in. I could have sworn it was in this book. I went through the index three times. It's not. But it's a great poem about this thing with the Sphinx. Where the I'll read it to you next time. It's a little comic poem, but it's really good. So here's what happens. He sets the city free. And all of a sudden, the queen rejoices. "Oh, Oedipus has set the city free. He has released us from a horrible curse. You will be my husband. You will take the place of my husband who has died. You will be the king." And Oedipus reigns for 20 years. That's when Oedipus the king begins. Oedipus Rex begins when Oedipus has already been reigning for 20 years.
In other words, he married his own mother?
Exactly. But does he know it?
No, not
he yet. Does not know it.
No.
Now, okay, listen carefully. Sharp. That is sharp, Tony. You're right on the ball. Now watch this. The play opens up with the chorus, who represent the people of, why do I want to say thieves? I know it's not thieves. I can't see it readily in my notes, so it's not that important. But anyway, he becomes, obviously, now, so the thing is, he's sent away from his I didn't know, I don't know why she didn't pick up on the limp, but she doesn't. But anyway, he goes away, and he comes back, and he fulfills the prophecy and kills his father. The old man he met at the crossroads was his father, right? And that's why the woman is widowed. Is this a good plot? I mean, I couldn't think of something like this. Right, right, to fulfill the prophecy. Good. No, he's leaving. He's leaving, he's going to find another place because he doesn't want to kill his father. And he thinks the other guy is his father.
The one he killed in the crossroads, the king at that time...
is just traveling. The king is just traveling. No, king is just traveling, and he ends up getting slain, okay? Now, but here's the idea. Oedipus kills a man. Why? Because of his stubborn pride. Okay? All right. Now, Paul, you're sitting in the audience. You're watching this. And you're saying, boy, oh boy, you know? Poor Oedipus. I mean, he doesn't know anything that's going on here. He's trying to be a good guy. He's trying, all right, he's got a problem. He's a little... But remember, we're living in a time that's much more violent. Well, I wouldn't say much more violent than today, but I mean, violence is much more accepted than it is today. Today, even when we hear about a police officer that gets killed in Boston, we say, oh, my God, that's awful. You know, it was a lot more violent back then. It, you know, violence was kind of a way of life for everybody. So now you're looking at this and you're saying, boy, poor Oedipus. What a life, you know. I mean, he's married to his own mother, doesn't know it. And all of a sudden, 20 years later, the first play, Oedipus Rex, or Oedipus the King. Rex means the king. Oedipus Rex begins. And it starts off with the community, the people of the city, standing before the palace, okay? Oedipus, the community standing before the palace. There is a great plague upon us, Oedipus. What will you do about the great plague that is now upon us? Let's see if I can find it for you very quickly. See, I'd have to read and read and read. Never mind. The idea is, they say, there's a great plague upon the city. What is happening? Why is the plague upon the city? Because he's married to his mother, and the gods,
right.
And the gods are, they hate that, but he doesn't know it. He's an innocent victim. You see what I mean? But he doesn't know he's married to his mother. Now, they don't know it either. Nobody knows why, but they're just saying, you're the king, save us from this plague.
So the gods are cursing it, by the
way. Right, the gods are cursing the city, nobody knows why. Oedipus, you're the king, help us. You've got an inroad with the gods, okay? Why does Oedipus have to be noble birth? Because he can do something about the problem, okay? They come to him with the problem. Now, the play goes on. And, oh, there's a plague. What could it possibly be? And finally, a seer comes in. Another one of these seers. And he's a blind seer. All kinds of imagery in this, folks. The crippleness of Oedipus speaks of the moral crippleness of the city. You get the idea? The moral degeneration of the city. The blindness of the seer speaks of what? The blindness of Oedipus to see what is very obviously happening. You know, all these imagery, this is how they're doing all of these things in this kind of convention. Now, I'm doing this for a reason, not just to teach you about drama, but I'm trying to teach you something about the Greeks, so make sure you stay plugged into that and how they're thinking, okay? What they do, and this is one of the things they're most famous for, is their drama. So what they do now is they're all sitting there and they're watching this and they're enthralled. This is one of the most magnificent, and Aristotle holds it up as the example. What could it be? The blind seer comes out. Oedipus, there is something, and he starts criticizing Oedipus, but he doesn't get very far before Oedipus says, you, old man, you've always wanted my throne, haven't you? You've always wanted to be where I am. You're jealous of me and all of this. And Oedipus will not listen to the seer. right? What is that? Hubris. Overreaching pride. Well, to make a long story short, folks, at the end of the play, he finds out why the city has been plagued. He's married to his mother. Now, she doesn't know this either. I don't remember exactly how this happens. She puts her eyes out. And by the way, that could never be shown on stage in ancient Greece, because this is an altar. Don't forget. This is an altar, and no violence could ever take place on the stage. The gods would look down upon that. You see what I mean? This was a convention. The violence, they would go outside, and they would say, "Oh, I'm putting my eyes out now. Oh, that one really hurt. Now I have to do the other one. Ah!" And it would be off stage. They could never show any kind of bloodletting like that on the stage, okay? By the time we get to the Elizabethan theater with William Shakespeare, that's all they're looking for. They're looking for sex. They're looking for violence. They're looking for blood. They're looking for... it's all peasants that are paying a penny to go in and see it and stand in front of the stage. They're called groundlings. People stink so bad. It's an outdoor arena, and people stink so bad that they sell citrus fruit, basically, so that they can keep it under their nose just to keep the smell from all the people around them sweating, watching these plays. And Shakespeare writes all these histories because he's really, you know, the histories are all, you know, really bloody. Richard II and Richard III and, you know, all of this stuff. Macbeth, you know, the trees of Dunsinane, the trees of Dunsinane Forest are coming, and all these people are getting killed left and right. They loved it. The groundlings loved it. Let's go see a play. And they loved Shakespeare because he gave them what they want. That's what Shakespeare was all about, giving the people what they wanted. But back in these days, it's not like that. It's not entertainment. It's religion. And they're sitting there. Now, you know what, Paul? You're going to watch poor Oedipus' life come crashing down before him. You know what you're going to say? I pray that the gods are kind to me. Because but for the grace of God, go I. It would be the same thing with me. What would I do if I brought this plague upon my city? Because you see what I mean? And every single person is sitting there watching this, and they're getting a cleansing, a catharsis. They're walking away clean. Okay? That's what Greek theater is all about.
How does he find out?
He finds out because the seer tells him. But the seer that he wouldn't listen to in the first place tells him. And that's when, you know, all the screaming happens and they kill each other and they put their eyes out. Now, the idea is this, though. Everybody, this is, why does he win the laurel wreath? Sophocles wins the laurel wreath every single time. Because the people are sitting there and they identify. They can get it. I get it. Antigone, which is also in this trilogy. Antigone, which is also in this trilogy, is... a girl, her brothers die, okay, and it's been so long since I read that. The idea is this: the brothers die, and one of them is a traitor, and the king says the traitor's body is to be left out there to rot in the field, and no one is to touch the body, okay. Antigone is the tragic hero in this play. And you know what she cannot stand? To see her brother lying in a field rotting. So she sneaks out at night, she buries him. What's her tragic flaw?
Pride.
No, not really pride. Sentimentality. But her sentimentality has gotten in the way of breaking the law. You see what I mean? And you know, so this is what the Greek tragedies were all about. Just a word about the Greek comedies. They were put in as filler material. They're very important to read because they tell us a lot of what was happening in society. When Socrates stands before Socrates he's a clown boy. We're going to definitely see Socrates. He gives a trial before Athens, and one of the things he's going to say is everybody thinks I'm a clown. You know why? Because of Aristophanes. Aristophanes play the clouds. Aristophanes got this play the clouds where Socrates is this guy who's going around, he's a philosopher, he's going around with his head in the clouds, and there's one part where he's in a basket, like, you know, a baby seat, a baby swing, and Socrates, his feet are like off the ground, and he's like walking, and he's like getting nowhere, and there's another part where he's sitting there, and a dog comes, and he's so wrapped up in thought that the dog thinks he's a fire hydrant or something, and everybody in the audience gets a big laugh, and he says, that's what everyone thinks of Socrates. He says, and that's why I'm going to be found guilty, not because I'm guilty. I'm going to be found guilty because of public opinion about me. And you know why Socrates gets found guilty? Because he's an imbecile and he gets himself found guilty. He provokes the jury. He's one of the most... what he says to the jury is absolutely obnoxious. We'll study it together. He ends up dying and drinking hemlock. He could have walked away any number of those times, but he decides to make himself a martyr. That's why he's called the secular Christ. He dies for a slogan. He dies for a philosophical belief, humanism, you know. Okay. Any questions, comments, anything like that? Yep. Absolutely nothing. They are nothing. Later on, they become, according to Aristotle, the first, anybody know who the first actor in world history was? His name was Thespis. Thespis. And that's why we have a thespian, right? A thespian is an actor, right? Thespis is the first, supposedly the first actor who ever lived. They're not regarded. It is the playwright. And, you know, and it's too bad. It's almost the opposite today. It's almost like somebody can write a very... You know, I saw this show recently. Has anybody ever seen... Does anybody like the theater? Anybody ever see Equus? Anybody ever see that play? Very famous play that was out. Maybe it didn't play good here, but it was a very famous play. It's about a guy who's going through a psychological thing. And Richard Burton made a film of it. Richard Burton was an absolutely magnificent actor and an incredible poetry reader as well. He had a voice that was... In my sullen craft and art exercised in the still night when only the moon rages and the lovers lie abed with all their griefs in their arms, I labor by singing light. He had that deep voice, you know. But he was a magnificent actor, and he played the part of the psychiatrist in Equus who's dealing with this kid who's really flipping out over horses. And it's a magnificent play filled with all kinds of things like Willie Loman and stuff like that. But in the play, you know what, after I got done watching it, I said, you know, that was magnificent. That was absolutely magnificent. And I'm thinking about what an incredible job Richard Burton did in this part. And then I'm thinking, you know, I don't even know who wrote that play. And that's what's too bad, because the artist is really not the actor. The actor, of course, is important, because he's going to put the, you know, nobody's going to play Rain Man like Dustin Hoffman. That's brilliant. I got to go to Wapner. I got to get Wapner. I got to watch Wapner. You know, you ever see Rain Man, the way he does that? It was unbelievable. Yeah, it was on, and I was watching a part of it. That's why I'm thinking about it. And he plays the part of a savant, who is like, a savant is someone who, like, keys into only certain things, and he's like, everything else is on the periphery. He doesn't understand. And it shows you what an absolutely brilliant actor this guy is. You know, it's absolutely magnificent. I don't even remember that. But the idea is it's really the person who's going to write the screenplay that, you know, as far as the theater is concerned, this should be remembered, you know. So, anyway, that's all we have to say about Greek theater. It's actually, I'll let it wait. Maybe not. There's 4 minutes left. Yes?
I believe Aristotle in the first play is the frogs about, it's actually the way war should end now. The war goes on about 10 or 15 years, and they can't end it. The two factions are fighting, so the women are getting sick of this. So, of course, the guys don't come back from the front, you know, for months back with their wives. So the wives get together, and they, on one side, the wives just say, that's it. They come back, no more sex, no more sexual relations. All of a sudden, a war that couldn't be ended in 15 years decides his wives won't provide anymore, so we're gonna end this war. And they go to the other side and say, what's the terms for the war?
They sign the papers and that's it. Is that right?
The war ends that quickly, like in about 3 months, although it couldn't be ended for 15 years. And if the women didn't do that, it would have gone on another 15 years.
Well, see, I've never read that. I know that The Frogs is a very famous play. I've never read it. Now, the thing is this, okay? Do you see why that is not ennobling? That would be a very... If you watch that, that would be an entertaining play. It's entertaining. And, you know, I mean, the plot is so absurd that it's lasted all this time in history and people still study it today. But it's not ennobling. Paul can't sit there and watch that and be cleansed. You get the idea? Tragedy makes you a better person, according to the Greeks. It lets you see the hubris in your life. It makes you see your tragic flaws, and you, by associating with that person, you too are cleansed. Okay? Are there any other questions? Excellent. Excellent point. Okay, let's close in prayer.